Hello, listeners, and welcome to the AfriWeta podcast, where we look to celebrate African history, people, and culture by telling our story. As always, our hope is that it fills you with enough curiosity to go and do your own deeper research. Karibuni to any new listeners to the AfriWeta world. We invite you to check out previous AfriWeta episodes, which can be found on this podcast platform. Thank you so much for tuning in. And today we're headed to the west of our continent for part one of the amazing Ashanti Empire, one of the most famous empires of the world. A shout out to my West Africans out there. AfriWeta has landed on your shores. I also want to say I do apologize in advance for the mispronunciation of words that will most definitely happen. But quickly before we begin, please remember to visit us on our socials. Our handle is at AfriWeta across all the platforms, where we post interesting facts, stories, updates, and links for further study for all you lovely people. And please remember to tell your family and friends. But for now, let's sit back and enjoy the journey. The Ashanti Empire is one of the most well-known African civilizations and an example of might and power globally. Its dominance within the continent was well documented, as were its interactions with the European foreigners. This was a major empire to study and research, and there are so many sources out there. Over the next two episodes, AfriWeta will cover as much as can be fit into the time we have together, but it will literally be a drop in the ocean. So, as usual, I ask that you, get out your maps so that you can trace where we are on the continent today. At its height, this empire physically spanned what is today's modern-day Ghana, parts of Togo and Côte d'Ivoire, but its influence was spread and felt far and wide, crisscrossing the West African region over to modern Niger, Liberia, and Benin. Some claim its population was up to about 4 million subjects, which at that time was massive, so it was pretty damn impressive. So now that we know where we are, let's see where it all began. We find ourselves in the court of Osei Tutu I, the founding father of the Ashanti Empire. All are settled in quietly. Our guide tells us that we're here to hear the origin tale. We then hear the Asantehene's drummer playing the gentle drum beats as he starts the story. Where is the origin of Osei Bediako? At the very beginning of creation, when Odoman Koma, the tireless creator, started creation. He created Abrankese Nya Meyani, the home of original creation and the home of Osei Bediako. He continues. Osei, the great warrior, led his people from the Adansi Hills to the new lands. The ancestors, the Amantu, were united as brothers, where clan was related to clan. Our clan, the Oyoko, migrated here to our present home, conquering and taking the chiefdoms of Bekwai, Dwaben, Kokofu, Kumasi, and Suta. Where we came from, the lands of Adanasi, Akrokeri, were no longer peaceful. Here in Kumasi, we found beautiful, fertile land. and it was here our great empire was then to find its base. And we took over all the lands as far as the eye could see. Victory after victory, we, the unstoppable Ashanti. We have been chosen. Our Sika Dwa Kofi came from the sky, confirming our place. It was brought down to us by the great priest, Komfo Anyoke, our great leader of the time, Osei Tutu I, the first of his name, the first of the Ashanti rulers, the first real Ashanti Hene. There is pin drop silence, and the next storyteller starts their part. Before his quest, Komfo Anoke gave instructions that all the rulers, the Omanhene of the clans, were to surrender the things of the past and that they were to bring their stools, weapons, and royal items to be buried underneath the river Bantama. When this was done, Komfo marked the site with a sword. And you can still see today, it still stands. The river was then given a new name. It was called Duore Jena, running over swords. Komfo allowed for only one royal item, the stool from the Oyoko, royal land of Ankiao Nyame. She had been bestowed a gold chain from the heavens with the promise that her lineage will never be forgotten and her descendants will always be honored. Once all the necessary requirements were done, Komfo Anyoke then called to the skies, calling for the creation of a symbol of the ultimate authority under which all would be bound and united. These unified peoples would then have their souls held by the symbol that would bring them power and prosperity. The Sika Dwa Kofi announced itself with thunder and lightning. A golden stool that stands 18 inches high, 24 inches long, and 12 inches wide dropped onto Osei Tutu's lap in front of all who had gathered on this special kofi. Once it landed, rituals took place establishing its sacred status. The crowd gathered, seeing a man and seven snakes absorbed when Komfo Anyoke struck it. And it proceeded to rub a special ointment made from nail, hair, and pubic hair clippings from all the chiefs who were gathered. From then on, it was decreed that the Sika Dwa Kofi, more commonly known as the famous golden stool, held the soul of the Ashanti. Its status meant it would never touch the ground and would always be placed on special blankets made of camel or elephant hide. And it was at this ceremony that our great Osei Tutu I became the official leader of the newly formed Ashanti Confederacy. And with that, the drumbeats faded away. We slowly find our surroundings changing as we are brought back to our time. So that is a dope origin story. Oh, and fun fact, the sword from the story still stands for real and can be found in the grounds of the Kumasi Central Hospital at Bantama. And it is said to be immovable by human might alone. Sound familiar? AfriWet would love to hear from our Akan descendants, their version of the Sika Dwa Kofi story. Please hit us up on our socials at AfriWetu or leave a message on the Anchor app. We might even play it. But let's go to the facts. So the Ashantis did indeed hail from the Akan people and can trace their roots to the Adansi Akrokeri area. They did move to the Kumasi area, displacing the inhabitants like the Asafo, Santreso, and Tafo peoples. Their new home offered not just great fertile lands, but was also easy to defend due to its landscape. It is also true that the first Ashanti ruler to take possession of the Sikadua Kofi was Osei Tutu I, who had emerged as the natural leader following the defeat of the powerful Denkyira kingdom in AD 1701 after successfully leading the allied forces to victory. But before we even get here, let's go further back, like way back. So if you remember in the last series, Africa to Series, Series 2, we looked at some of the great Sudanic empires, Mali and Songhai to be exact. So indulge me with a quick segue. These empires relied heavily on the gold trade, which was a huge source of the wealth. And one of the key sources of said gold was the Wangara peoples, whose territory was just bursting with the precious metal. So all this was also to ask you to go and listen to these empire episodes, but also for you to see that the gold business was not uncommon in this region. In the early 17th century, the great trading cities such as Jene and others like Bego in modern Ghana and Kafabo in the Volta region would have also had Akan, long-distance traders, come to trade with their gold and other goods like kola nuts and ivory. So these Akan people, some of them settled in the forest region in the Pra and Ofin River areas circa 15th century. You then had the Akan clans, who later formed the Ashanti. That was the Bekwai, the Dwaben, the Kokofu, the Kwaman, the Mampon, and then Nsuta. Afriwet will cover the other Akan states and peoples in the future. So our Ashanti were among the last of the Akan subclan to emerge as a powerful kingdom. Other powerful kingdoms who were already in existence in the Akan land were the Akwamu in the east, Bono Mansu, Manso in the north, and Denkyira in the west, all of whom were later absorbed by the Ashanti in the 18th century. The Ashanti culture is heavily influenced by the core Akan culture, and it is claimed by some that the story of the Sikadua Kofi has a direct link to that of the Efanakwa, the mystical sword that was conjured up by Aurade Basa, the leader of the Adanse Manso. This sword was also the unifying and royal symbol of leadership and first originated from the Adansi. So, before we head to the next section, while we're still here with the Akan, interesting fun fact time. The Akan calendar, which is what the Ashantis follow. It has a 40-day cycle with 6 days in a week, and it's broken down like so. There's Fo, which is the council day, Nuna, which is a sleep or death day, Nki, which is a taboo day, Kuru, which is a political day, Kwa, which is a rest day, and Mono, which is a fresh start day. Then also in this calendar, you have special sacred days, four of them to be exact, which are namely Fodwo, Awukudai, Fofi, and Awasidai. Now, I know I have butchered these pronunciations for sure, so my Afriwetu from the region, please, please, please help your sister out and send in the correct pronunciations. Let's now go to the next section, which is about the military. So a lot is said about the Ashanti as a military people, as well as about the many wars it participated in. And the basis for the military was rooted again in the Akan culture. And Osei Tutu brought these from his years living in Denkyira, where he lived for a time in his youth, as well as his experiences with the Akwamu. The Ashanti did not have a standing army to begin with. It was composed of soldiers who came from the kingdoms within its control. They would be called up for duty and once deployed could be out in the field for years. On return, they would go back to their respective homes, not to any barracks. The army was then split into the following main sectors. First, you had the personal guard, the Gyase. Then you had the Adonten, the main body who were the caretakers of the palace. So they were at the forefront of protecting the realm. Third and fourth, you had the advance guard, the Twafo, and the rear guard. Then we have the scouts known as the Akwanzrafo. Then you have the last two sections, which were the Benkum, the left wing, and the Nifa, the right wing. Then within each of these wings was a further split of the Nifa Nse, that was the right and right half, and the Benkum Nse, that was the left and left half. Outside of a purely military function, i.e. fighting, the military also provided social, political, and administrative functions. Ashanti were able to maneuver and climb the social ladder to more favorable posts and social standing, even as far as breaking into nobility circles, a favor that was bestowed on those who were deemed loyal. The sons of Ashanti nobility were also known to take positions in the military because they could also enhance and secure their own social standing in the elite. The Ashanti army was admired for its effectiveness, efficiency, as well as, I read in one piece, that they were basically quite cool under pressure. African men, just posers wherever possible, right? Anyway, it was just as well that they were effective because even when you look at the Ashanti expansion, let's just understand the context of that period and what this army faced. So there were a number of threats both internally, i.e. the civilizations within its sphere, so conquered kingdoms, and externally against other powerful states like Dahomey. Afriwetu covered Dahomey in Series 2, Episodes 5 and 6, so check it out. So with Dahomey, they fought a major battle in AD 1763 when the Ashanti encroached on their lands. Then you also had the Sarem provinces, where war broke out in AD 1780, who were pretty strong in themselves because they dealt quite a few strategic blows to the Ashanti before finally being subdued. And then you had alliances like the Akim, Fanti, Woso, Twifo, the most powerful of the southern middle states. And it is said that their key mission and the glue that held them together was the absolute aim at ensuring that Ashanti didn't get any hold of any firearms, which would boost their expansion plans. And since we're now talking about expansions, I guess now is a good time to look at it, yes? So the empire's expansion was obviously made all the more rapid by the well-oiled machine that was the Ashanti armies. The military and conquest history is so rich that Afriwetu can't do it justice in just this short period. So please be sure to go and check it out yourself. So the emergence of this powerful empire is part of the rich oral history of the Ashanti, and there's stories that are told during special festivals like the Adai and Odwira festivals. The base of the Ashanti was Kumasi, where they had settled back in the late 15th century, and by AD 1670, the Ashanti kingdom was formed. This kingdom then started the process of absorbing the neighboring civilizations who shared common cultures. The start of its real imperial era was the Great War with the powerful kingdom of that day in the region, Dienkira, which Afriwetu will cover, I promise. The Dienkira kingdom was a Twi-speaking Akan forest people who wielded a lot of power and was very wealthy due to its profitable trade in gold and indentured people on the West African coast. As with any power, there were rumblings from those kingdoms under its rule agitating to throw off its yoke. And so, an alliance was formed between the kingdoms of Akiani, Akwamu, Akiem, Aowin, Wassa, Twifo, as well as others. This alliance was then led by, you guessed it, Osei Tutu I, who is said to have prepped for war for 3 years. I mean, guys, success is a process. Anyway, in AD 1701, that was the start of the end for Dienkira in the Battle of Feyiase. Its capital, Abankesoso, was invaded, sacked, and it was already in a weakened state, having lost a number of its inhabitants who had fled in the run-up to the war. Therefore, Dienkira, after dominating the region from the 1660s, was finally beaten. As part of the spoils of war, the territories that sat under this kingdom, such as the Asin, Sehui, Twifu, and Wasau, were forced to pledge allegiance, pay tribute, show political affiliation, and subordination to the Ashanti. This was a very bitter pill to swallow, and it was not a given. Take, for example, the case of the Twifu, who only succumbed to being a tribute state in AD 1715 after much force was used. Once they plus other Denkyira allied states were more or less under control, Osei Tutu I then had the even bigger task of ensuring that the diverse states would fall in line and be loyal to the Ashanti. In fact, let's take a quick glance at the other notable kingdoms that were annexed to become part of this Ashanti before we head over to how the empire was governed. So, in AD 1721, the Ashanti took charge of Wasau. In AD 1721-1722, they added Ahafo to the growing empire. In AD 1722-1723, Bonso Manso fell. Quick thing about Bonso Manso. It was said to have the best goldsmiths, impressive blacksmiths, carvers, and artisans. So much so that when it fell, these skilled folk were taken to work in the Kumasi court for the Ashanti nobility. And it is from this area that the origins of gold ornaments and adornment of persons or things was a commonplace practice that the Ashanti adopted. And we can see this in the stool regalia, for example, with the Kumasi stool. Then we had, in AD 1807, the Ashanti-Fanti Wars, which are very well documented, so go and read on them. One of the key factors of these wars was trade routes and control of the trade along the coast, especially that of indentured people. In AD 1814, our Ashanti waged war and defeated the Akim and Akwapim alliance, forcing them to become tributes and leverage on their vantage point, gaining access to the foreign traders on the coast. And the last one to mention, very quickly, is the conquest of Gyaman in two parts. First, in AD 1740, the Gyaman were defeated, becoming part of the empire after the Asante-Gyaman War. This area was rich in gold, but it was also valuable as its position created a buffer from the non-Akan states to the northwest of the Ashanti. The Gyaman did manage to get free of the Ashanti, but was later taken back in AD 1818-1819. Okay, so I know I said this would be a quick look, but I have to tell a story about this conquest because it was just such a good one. So bear with me. So this is a story of what caused the second invasion of the Gyaman by the Ashanti. So we find ourselves in the capital city, Sampa. Our guide greets us. Welcome to Gyaman. Let me show you to the royal courts. Our queen is arriving soon. All this fanfare is for her. I will make sure you have the best views. So off we go, following our guide to the courts, the music, the people, the color, it's a proper festival. Our guide tells us we can stay here and watch the dances and eat some good food on our way to the courts. So we do. By the time we get to the courts, we find that there's been a little bit of fracas and we ask, what's going on? Our guide tells us, the Kwado Adinkira, our ruler, loves his gold, so much so that he made sandals and adornments for his personal goods, but then he went a step further and made a golden stool. And rumor has it that Ama Taima, his sister, is the one who pushed him to do it. Wait, what? But surely won't that send the wrong message to the Ashanti ruler, the Ashanti Hene? Yes, says our new friend. In fact, this was in direct conflict to the uniqueness of the Kumasi Sikadwa Kofi. Needless to say, it did not go down well. So then what happened is the Asante Hene sent for this stool to be surrendered to his envoy, Kwame Butu Akwawa, to bring back to Kumasi. Ah, so it's sorted, right? We say, what's the problem? It's like, now, she says, the problem is this. Ama Taima, our queen, has come back to find that the stool has gone and is now demanding that a new stool is made. Kwadwo is not keen because, you know, this is now a proper direct affront, but it still looks like her will pass. We shall see. Next thing, we find ourselves transported further ahead in time, back to the same royal court, and this time, Amataima is holding court with her brother, debating with a man who looks, from his outfit, with royal emblems and his entourage, like the Asante Henne's envoy. He looks annoyed, as Ama is insulting the Asante Henne and his emissaries, calling them all sorts of names, including a tortoise. Which was quite an insult in Akan culture because it was a symbol for impotence anyway. But she doesn't stop there. Oh, no, 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 no. She tells him about how it is she who is the power of the throne and her brother was at her mercy. That of the two, she was the man and she would take her people to war without fear. She was not the coward her brother was. And using a few more choice words and descriptions that are not for the faint-hearted, I promise you, on she went. The fact was, indeed, she truly had the power because no one even dared to stop her chastising this emissary. She then sent the Asante Henne's people back to Kumasi, empty-handed and being furious at having been unceremoniously and thoroughly insulted. So, as we get back to our time, we find out that, unfortunately, the fate of our brave Amataima wasn't great. Following the insults, war was declared and her brother was killed in the course of battle with the Ashanti. There are different versions as to his death. One goes as far as to declare that he was beheaded posthumously. And that is a whole other story, not for this episode. She herself, our Ama, was allegedly sold as a wife to Kwado Sanpini. And so, Gayaman was once again conquered. So, how was this vast empire governed, I hear you ask? Well, let's take a look. In general, the governance setup was based on the Akan system, a chieftainship structure. Conquered lands were treated differently in regards to their ruling families, depending on various factors as well. There was no strict uniformity or methodology with the Ashanti in this regard. So it depended on the territory's classification, of which the main ones were the tributaries, protectorates, and provinces. So with protectorates, they would participate in the war effort, but with the added criteria that they were loyalists and were treated with a light touch rule from the Ashanti. They were not considered troublemakers who were agitating for independence, and in fact, were perfectly happy to be part of the Ashanti sphere of influence. Then you have the provinces, whose people also took part in the Ashanti Wars, but with a more rigid form of management, so not as light as the former. They were more like subject states. Then you had the tributary states, those who sent tribute to the Ashanti and were represented by emissaries as opposed to petitioners. They tended to be commercially tied to the Ashanti, whether conquered or partnered. Some of them were under threat or viewed as a threat. Others had a more harmonious relationship. But these states were not actually core to the empire and many times were not Akan, and thus no real shared culture. But they served very useful purposes economically and politically. So when we go to the various ways of governing these states, the Ashantis, like many across the continent, used two main methods. The first one was keeping the status quo, an indirect rule through the existing structure and nobility. The second was to remove the nobility, usually through a violent act. I mean, they wouldn't just be left to roam the streets. So they were either exiled or killed. And then, in their place, an Ashanti chief from the pool of nobility based in Kumasi was placed. The Ashanti would instill loyalty, fealty, and subservience using state tools like making states swear oaths of allegiance, provide soldiers, and have them accept the supremacy of the Kumasi courts. States were also obligated to pay taxes and follow any decrees made regarding trade. The leaders of these states were expected to attend important cultural festivals like the annual Ashanti Henne's Odwira, the Feast of the Dead, which closed the Ashanti year. And speaking of the Asante Henne, now is probably a good time to take a closer look at the general structure within the ruling classes. First things first, I just wanted to point out that the Ashanti followed a matrilineal hereditary system. I mean, African women just keep killing it. This is also the case when it came to getting a title. We'll hear a little bit more about the role of women in Ashanti society a little bit later in the show. So back to the structure. The Ashantehene did not have absolute power, and he actually ruled with the aid of a special council, the Ashante Kotoko. Kotoko, which means porcupine. This council consisted of the Ashantehema, who was the Ashantehene's mother, sister, aunt, or a woman who was assigned this role. She had a clear politically defined role constitutionally and co-ruled the empire along the Ashantehene. The council also consisted of the Kumasi nobility and selected chiefs from the Ashanti, those whose states formed the core political allies. The Omahene, who were powerful in their own right, these were the chiefs, ruled their own lands, citizens, and commanded their own armies. Then you also had in this council the powerful Nsafohene, who were part of the ruling elite and Asantehene loyalists. And it is from them that the Asantehenes would then elevate those who had proven themselves as loyal. So they could become commanders of the state army and in some cases, civilian roles such as managing the national coffers and administrators ruling as proxies for the Asantehene. The Ashanti governed using constitutional and religious customs and laws, which all were bound to. They also instilled payment of taxes and tributes in the form of kola, gold, ivory, crafts, etc. And one had to swear an oath of allegiance to the sacred Sika Dua Kofi. This oath was usually carried out at the annual religious festivals, the Odwira, and each year these chiefs would have to reaffirm their allegiance. So while studying this empire, I came across very many interesting facts. And this is one related to Kumasi, the capital, which I wanted to share here before we go to our next section. So, Kumasi was the commercial and political hub, and it is the seat of government. The name itself is derived from the Kum tree, under which it was said Osetutu I sat under to negotiate occupancy. The ruling elite lived in the city as the seat of power, and people came for business and royalty came for functions. So this meant the population of the city would drastically increase and decrease on a seasonal basis. Estimates range in the tens of thousands on a regular day that could swell up to just over 100,000. So the interesting fact is how seriously the Ashanti took their capital city of Kumasi. So for the business traveler, they were stopped en route. They would have to state their business. This was then communicated to the powers that be, and those travels would only be allowed through once permission was granted. And then they would have to be escorted in by an appointed guide. European foreigners were also subject to the same strict protocols. They would have to wait outside of Kumasi to be summoned by the Ashantehene. This wait could vary from a couple of days to a few weeks. And if they dared to complain, well, they'll just be made to wait longer. In fact, it was a violation under pain of death for the Ashanti who was responsible if these foreigners entered Kumasi without being granted express permission. Once an audience was granted, they were then taken in under military guard, and during their stay, they were kept under observation right up until they left. Visitors would be accorded a welcome reception depending on who they were meeting and the nature of their visit. For those who are guests of the Ashantehene, they would be housed, and in the early years, this would be on the state's account. The royal treasurer would also provide finances for daily nourishment. And then, when it came time to leave, there were still various customs to be followed. One didn't just exit Kumasi like that. Oh, no. It required permission from the royals and certain conditions had to be met. The reasons varied from the day not being auspicious enough, a palaver that needed to be settled, and sometimes it could even be because the escorts just weren't ready to guide them out of the city. So now that we know how they treated guests who came to their capital, what about those of theirs who went out? So the Ashanti had two main classes of officials in this space of international relations. There were the ambassadors, who in their capacity could act on behalf of the Ashantehene and the government as one with full authority to do so, as they do today, really. They traveled with sizable entourages dressed in the finest material, which were easily identifiable as high-level diplomats. And it was expected that they would be received with respect befitting their position, as well as being accorded immunity. The second classification were the couriers. And again, similar today, they were purveyors of messages and did not have any authority to negotiate, discuss, or make decisions. They too had distinct symbols linking them to their mission and position. These symbols came in the guise of special canes, staffs, or for those who were under direct royal instructions, a gold-gilded sword. They were also those held by the okra, who were identified by holding large golden discs. They were the trusted keepers of the Ashantehene's messages. Diplomatic envoys were granted permission to travel without hindrance under the Ashantehene's name, which was revered throughout the region. And now, Afriwatu, as we finish this episode, let's have a look at the role of women in Ashanti society. So women were respected within society in general, a society which followed the Abusua family structure, the word depicting matrilineal in Ashanti, which was then led by the Abusua Panin and Oba Panin, the male and female elders of the household. Women were revered as mothers and considered wise counsel, thought to provide a social balance to their more moderate reasoning, which was valued in a society that had a very strong military culture. Women also played a critical role as a sort of moral voice when it came to local politics and religious practice. Deities were also split into male and female. In fact, some deities had to have a priestess to carry out rituals and be their spokesperson. When it came to politics, at the local level, there was the Ohene, the chief, and the Ohema, the queen mother, as the axis of power. This was then replicated in the higher echelons of the noble class, right through to the Ashantehene and the Ashantehema, the king and queen mother. The two were co-rulers in all respects, and the Ashantehema was seen as the balance to the Ashantehene's power and was there to provide advice on all matters, including whether or not to wage war. So it was not a mere symbolic role. It was a practical, and furthermore, powers were enshrined in the constitution. She had a position in the powerful council that governed the empire, the Ashanti Kotoko, as we spoke of earlier, where she was part of basically the powerful state system where crucial matters concerning the empire were debated. Then there was a very cool fact I found in my research, and this related to the reverence of menopausal and postmenopausal women. They were seen as on par to the men in society, and this included even in the military. They would be tasked with performing protection rituals for the soldiers when they went into war. So basically, old African women are also badass, and don't you forget it. Right, so what else was going on in the world during this time? So, in AD 1603, Lizzie I dies. Then in 1610, King Henry IV of France was assassinated. 1649, King Charles I is executed. 1633, Galileo faces the Roman Inquisition. Then you had the disasters in Europe. AD 1666, the Great Fire of London. 1692 to 1694, there's famine in France that kills 2 million people. 1696 to 1697, famine in Finland, which kills a third of the population. And then, between 1600 and 1700, let me tell you people, there were a lot of wars on the European shores. So I'm just going to name a few of them. So you had the Battle of Kinsale, which is between England and Spain. You had the Battle of Kushimo, the Polish-Lithuanians versus the Russian-Swedish forces. The 30-year war that devastated Europe began. The Polish-Ottoman war over Moldova. The wars of the Three Kingdoms, Ireland, Scotland and England. The Portuguese wars. The English Civil War. The Northern Wars of Sweden. The Anglo-Dutch wars. The Devolution War. France and the Netherlands. There was a lot of fighting going on up that side. Anyway, let's come back to our continent, yeah? So, in part two, we have a whole lot more to uncover about this amazing empire and the people. We will look at their trade and economy, we'll dig in to understand their societal structures and how it is governed, and meet some dope famous people to boot. So come back then. But before we leave, let's bring it home, okay? As always, I am amazed and awed by the rich history from our continent. Like, it's a deep well with basically no end in sight. And the Ashanti Empire is really and truly no different. I really hope that after this episode and the next, you will realize that they were more than simply a warring empire, but indeed there was a very rich culture within as well. One of my favorite things was the treatment of older women in society. It is a very African thing, something we forget as we absorb other cultures. We should always remember ours and the great things that were. African women commanded and still command a special space in the world. So my sisters, own it, yes? Then, as usual, how dope was this empire? I mean, we're only just done with the first part. Their military history was just awesome. The expansion was impressive and the culture beyond rich. I mean, I keep using the word rich, but beyond rich. So my people, please go off and read more and do your own deeper research. Remember to come back for part two. But for now, until next time, Mubarikiwe.
Do I lay ya, bitima?